One of the challenges with certain Christian holy days is that they originate in the Hebrew calendar, which is based on the moon, whereas our Gregorian calendar is based on the sun. Since there isn't a whole number of lunar months in one solar year, there's a drifting mismatch. So Easter, you may have noticed, moves around the Gregorian months of March and April, because Passover begins on the 15th of the Hebrew month of Nisan. A lesser-known Jewish holy day is Shavuot, the Feast of Weeks, which commemorates the giving of the Torah on Mount Sinai and is celebrated precisely 7 weeks after Passover. It's also known as Pentecost, and as a Christian holy day takes place 7 weeks after Easter. Oh, and the Western and Eastern branches of Christianity have different dates too. Confused? You're not alone. Our reading this morning comes from the Christian Scriptures book of Acts, which follows the death of Jesus and explains the significance of Pentecost. When the Feast of Weeks had come, the disciples were all together in one place. And suddenly there came a sound like the rushing of wind, and it filled the house where they were sitting. Divided tongues, as of fire, appeared among them, and a flame-like tongue rested on each of them. All of them were filled with the Holy Spirit and began to speak in other languages, as the Spirit gave them ability. Now there were devout Jews from every nation under heaven living in Jerusalem. And at this sound, the crowd gathered and was bewildered, because each one heard the native language of each. Amazed and astonished, they asked, "Are not all of these who are speaking Galileans? And how is it that we hear, each of us, in our own native language?" All were amazed and perplexed, saying to one another, "What does this mean?" But others sneered and said, "They are filled with new wine."
Wait and see what a world there can be if
There are a lot of bogus claims about religion out there. For instance, there never was an original, singular, unified form of Christianity to which, if only everyone returned, then all of the world's problems would be solved. That's either false nostalgia or politically motivated nonsense. Rather, Christian communities spent the first handful of centuries figuring out, in other words, arguing about, what their religion actually was. One of the many disputes that occupied the early church concerned the nature of Jesus. There were lots of different opinions. Some believed that Jesus was a man, albeit a man sent by God. Some believed that Jesus was the incarnation of some pre-existing divine principle. Some believed that Jesus was a particular role that God had assumed. Some believed that Jesus was fully divine and only appeared to be human. Every group had its own way of trying to understand the importance of Jesus without needing more than one deity. As the Christian church began to organize itself into a hierarchy, those with more senior positions were able to speak with greater authority on such matters. In the early 4th century, for instance, the Bishop of Alexandria in Egypt tried to resolve the issue of the nature of Jesus by proposing that Jesus, as the Son of God, possessed eternal divinity, having always been of the same essence as God the Father. That proposal didn't go as far as he planned. A local priest named Arius countered that no, Jesus was inferior to God, with an essential nature somewhere between the human and the divine. This turned into such a big deal that there was rioting in Alexandria, and the dispute spread to other parts of the Roman Empire too. It was so bad that the emperor himself intervened. In the year 325, Constantine convened the Council of Nicaea, bringing together all of the bishops to figure it out. It was actually Constantine himself who suggested the language that Jesus the Son and God the Father were of one essence. And when the vote was taken, only two of the more than 200 bishops voted against that idea. They also adopted a creed to prevent any further dispute, and then they named Arius a heretic and they exiled him. In some accounts, by the way, the debate became so heated that Arius was punched in the face by none other than the bishop who was later the inspiration for Santa Claus. Let that image sink in for a minute. The creeds formulated by later councils explicitly named as the Trinity the consubstantial and co-eternal unity of Father, Son, and Holy Spirit. And though there were some further disagreements as the Roman Empire split apart, leading to a Western or Latin church based in Rome and an Eastern or Greek church based in Constantinople, the nature of Jesus, as far as they were concerned, was effectively settled. And when the Protestant Reformation took place 1,000 years later, Martin Luther, John Calvin, and the rest either downplayed the Trinity or simply left it out of their liturgies. It wasn't that they disputed it as such. Rather, they knew it wasn't actually in the Bible, and so they didn't think it was that important. That changed when Michael Servetus came along. A brilliant young man who studied the Bible in Hebrew and Greek, he had witnessed the corruption of Christianity by Rome and wanted to take the Reformation even further. In 1531, Servetus published a book entitled On the Errors of the Trinity, reevaluating the nature of Jesus on the basis of the relationship between humanity and God, attempting to replace the traditional understanding of the Trinity with a more biblical one. He proposed that it was the Holy Spirit moving within the human heart that lifts humanity closer to God, with Jesus, the paragon Son of God, who thus makes it possible for humans in general to become children of God. Servetus tried to convert others to his philosophy, including the leading Protestants, but his relentless and eventually insulting letters to them only turned them against him, with the side effect, ironically but perhaps predictably, of making the traditional doctrine of the Trinity more important. Now, we claim both Arius and Servetus as our spiritual ancestors on the Unitarian side of our religious heritage, even though it's arguable that they weren't really Unitarians. And indeed, a rejection of the Trinity is something that has sporadically appeared throughout history and continues to do so worldwide today, wherever Christians read their Bibles and start to ask questions about the relationship between Jesus and God. In the late 16th century Poland, for example, a number of factions of anti-Trinitarians were united under the leadership of Faustus Socinus, where the Minor Reformed Church of Poland, as it was known, went on to prosper for 60 years. Though there was always tension with the Polish Calvinist Church, not to mention threats from bands of militant Jesuits, it is said that during the period of stability and growth, Jews in Poland would sometimes claim to be with the minor church, since that might at least allow them to avoid persecution. Given that a rejection of the Trinity is something that has kept appearing throughout history, it's perhaps not surprising that it would do so here in the United States too. While American Universalism has clear roots back to Europe, American Unitarianism is entirely homegrown. It was in New England, and particularly eastern Massachusetts, that some ministers and their congregants began to call themselves liberal Christians, embracing reason and tolerance and free thought while rejecting both Calvinism and the Trinity. At first, they were able to coexist with the rest of New England Congregationalism, but in time, the Orthodox ministers began to exclude their liberal colleagues from fellowship. There was even a pamphlet campaign aiming to prove that the liberal Christians were, in their unorthodoxy, none other than heretical Unitarians. The turning point came almost exactly 200 years ago, when liberal Christian minister William Ellery Channing stopped refusing to be called a Unitarian and instead embraced the name. It was in May 1819 at the ordination of Jared Sparks as minister of what is now the First Unitarian Church of Baltimore that Channing delivered his sermon on Unitarian Christianity, laying out, first, liberal methods for interpreting the Bible, and second, the consequences of such methods when it comes to matters such as the unity of God, the humanity of Jesus, and the nature of morality. His sermon clocked in at more than an hour and a half long. And with no amplification of Channing's voice in a church with bad acoustics to help anybody except those very close to the pulpit hear him, Jared Sparks himself arranged for the publication of the sermon so that it could become more widely read. With multiple editions, it became the most widely circulated pamphlet in American history. And, transforming the liberal Christians' understanding of themselves, they organized in 1824 as their own denomination, calling it the American Unitarian Association. Now, there's an assumption that to be a Unitarian means going back to God the Father, the first person of the Trinity, but without there being a Trinity, of course, the same one God as in Judaism. And Channing's Baltimore sermon does indeed mention God some 150 times, which works out to be about 3 mentions every 2 minutes. Channing also names Jesus or Christ about 50 times, but only mentions the Holy Spirit once in the entire hour and a half sermon. And up until humanism emerged as a major force within American Unitarianism in the early 20th century, it was indeed the one God that was the focus of theology. Jesus was an important and thoroughly human example of what it means to be a good human, with his consistent message of loving one another and his relentless criticism of economic inequality. Of course, with transcendentalism and the growing awareness of Eastern religions, the Christian part of Unitarianism became one among many available options for religious understanding and inspiration for justice. And as for the third person of the Trinity, the Holy Spirit, well, that just sort of disappeared along the way. It seems like the Holy Spirit has always been the odd one out, though. Most traditionally Christian churches rarely make much of the Holy Spirit, except around Pentecost. Then there's the fact that it has something of a counterpart in Jewish theology, for all that Judaism is Unitarian with a lowercase u. Though not found in the Hebrew Bible, the Shekinah is the spiritual presence of the divine, particularly in terms of the feminine attributes of the divine. In any case, it's much more common for spirit to be used in some metaphorical sense, hearkening back to its root that Paul talked about, meaning in terms of breath, to refer to what animates and motivates us, allowing us to understand, say, between a more literal reading of some text and a more generous interpretation of the words. But a few things have happened to Unitarianism over the last century. There was, as I mentioned, a major shift with the development of humanism, allowing for the expansion of the faith not just beyond Christianity, but beyond theism too. In other words, it was no longer necessary to believe in God to be a Unitarian. As the story goes, there was a memorial service for someone who had been a lifelong Unitarian, and someone who was not a UU was at that service to honor his friend, but knowing something of our history in rejecting the doctrine of the Trinity, he said he knew that Unitarians believe in one God. A woman who was a UU immediately chimed in. "You mean," she called out, "we believe in at most one God." There was also the women's rights movement and the development of feminism, which called into question the use of exclusively masculine imagery to describe the divine. For instance, much of the work that went into this hymnal involved reworking traditional verses so that they didn't, or at least didn't just, refer to God the Father, but used more inclusive language. And if God could no longer be claimed as male, then the civil rights movement and the development of multiculturalism similarly required that God no longer be claimed as white either. In fact, with so many conceptions of God tied up with patriarchal notions inherited from feudal Europe, it's no wonder that Unitarian Universalism has found other ways to speak theologically, whether in terms such as the divine, the oversoul, or the interdependent web, or the beloved community, or the mystery, or the transcendent, or the greater whole, or the source of all, or the spirit of life. Carolyn McDade's prayer, "Spirit of Life," is certainly popular within Unitarian Universalism, but we often set aside any question of what it means that we're apparently addressing such words to the Spirit of Life. And many congregations do this. The 2005 report, Engaging Our Theological Diversity, produced after 4 years of research and study by the Unitarian Universalist Association's Commission on Appraisal, noted that Spirit of Life is by far the most common UU hymn, or at least is second only to the use of a hymn as a children's recessional. When I was in seminary, a non-UU seminary, it was even used by non-UUs who felt it expressed something that simply wasn't available in one of their own tradition's hymns. Then there's what happened at the UUA's 2002 General Assembly in Quebec City. I was to carry my congregation's banner in the parade that is part of the opening ceremony, and as we lined up in a waiting room to get ready for the parade, someone who was there from another congregation had a heart attack. As medical staff arrived to help him and get him to a hospital, someone started to sing Spirit of Life. More people joined in, singing it again and again, not at all loudly, an expression of support for the man who had collapsed and for those who had been affected by seeing him suffer. And Spirit of Life has been sung in classes, at protests, in memorial services. It's been translated into other languages too, as you heard in Spanish this morning. But it's hardly the only song in our repertoire to invoke spirit in one sense or another. I picked hymns this morning to do just that, and there are plenty more I could have chosen besides. I think, in fact, that in our music in particular, we sing about spirit more than we do any other divine metaphor. And in spoken words, Unitarian Universalists as a whole are much more willing to embrace Spirit of Life or Spirit of Love or some such phrase in place of God or any other term that often comes with too much baggage. Thanks to Spirit of Life, in fact, UU ministers can even get away with actually praying out loud once in a while. So here's the thing. Just as the Universalist side of our religious heritage continued to evolve, so has our Unitarian side. We are not William Ellery Channing Unitarians any more than we are John Murray or Hosea Ballou Universalists. But if we're allowed to pick any one of the three persons of the Trinity as our unity, and who says we're not, then it appears that over the 200 years since Channing preached on Unitarian Christianity, we've effectively decided to pick the third person, the Spirit. As it happens, I know a number of clergy in both the United Church of Christ and the Disciples of Christ who, in their personal theologies, are really Unitarians. I suspect that many UCC and Disciples members are too, which isn't surprising given that they are our closest cousins, as it were, having also emerged from New England Congregationalism. It's why some people, even UCC ministers, joke that UCC really stands for Unitarians Considering Christ. But whereas they, like Channing, talk about God in the tradition of the biblical Yahweh, making them from a Trinitarian perspective Unitarians of the first person, we Unitarian Universalists are actually Unitarians of the third person. Now, this should be more than just a, that's interesting point of information. I mean, I've given you a good chunk of UU history this morning, barely scratching the surface of more than 2,000 years of religious and cultural developments, but still more than the 5 minutes I'm able to give at one of our membership orientations. But there should be more to this experience, this hour of your life in this room with friends and future friends, than sending you on your way knowing something you didn't know before. What difference will it make in your life and in the lives with which you interact during this week for knowing this now? Here's one difference I'm hoping it will make. We are looking at a future, a near-term future, in which we can do one of two things. Either we will all rise together, or we will all fall together. The problems we face on this planet, from gun violence to the climate emergency, the fact that we're so interconnected, make those the only two options. Either we will all rise together, or we'll all fall together. For the last half century, Unitarian Universalism has been an ongoing multi-site experiment in figuring out how we can rise rather than fall. It hasn't been an entirely intentional process, but we've arrived at a place in our practical theology that can hold not just religious pluralism, but multiculturalism too. And not just hold them, but nourish them. To be a Unitarian of the third person is to be a universalist too. It's a faith in which the religious impulse, our human response to the dual reality of being alive and having to die, is expressed in terms of spirit, something much more accommodating and expansive than any conception of God. It can help us focus on what we have in common, lifting up our similarities so that we can celebrate our differences rather than being afraid of them, helping us to see beyond our own narrow concerns to the greater community of life that holds and shapes us all. And when we speak of the Spirit, does it matter that different people might mean something different? No, that's the great thing about it. To some, maybe it does mean the Holy Spirit of the Trinity. And if that works for them, then great. To others, maybe it means the Shekinah. To others, maybe it's a metaphor, a powerful metaphor for what animates and motivates us in life. And that's okay too. It might not literally give us the power to speak in foreign languages, but it does allow everyone to understand in their own theological language. When all is said and done, we can be with one another and we can sing our prayer, our desire for compassion to be stirred in our hearts, our hope for life that is given the shape of justice. May it be so.